like formal, what we call like formal meditation, where you actually practice samadhi and take time to. This is a good practice to cultivate, because daily life can be just going from one thing to another, and this idea of having periods of just stopping, where you watch the breath or collect yourself from the maybe busy, active life. So if it's possible, you know, because sometimes we live in situations where we have not much privacy or opportunity. But when we do, that's good to integrate it into one's life. Like it gives a form, a quality. And also, we do forget. We get carried away with our vipaka karma, like the resultant karma of past actions. And this also helps us to periods of silent meditation, of sitting, walking. We begin to get perspective on it, and we become more confident. Like over the years, the confidence in the practice increases as you witness the result of it. So then it applies to not just the formal meditation exercises, but just life itself. So, you know, when one integrates mindfulness into traveling, into the workplace, into just doing the most ordinary things, ordinary, mundane, daily activities. And so much of our life is a kind of habit pattern, perfunctory kind of doing things, because that's what we're used to doing. Where mindfulness puts it in a perspective, we begin to not just operate out of the momentum of habit or compulsion. We have compulsive tendencies in regards to certain things, and these can all be seen in terms of being aware, listening, beginning to see them from the wisdom level rather than the personal problem attitude. Because we're not practicing to get rid of our personality, but to no longer be deluded by it. For example, Ajahn Chah was a very charming personality. He was charismatic. And so this was, one monk asked him, "You're very charming. Is this a problem?" And he called it his magnet. He could draw people in and then kind of charm them. And then they began to listen to Dhamma. When he saw they were ready, then he could teach them Dhamma. Other monks or meditators may not have charisma or personal charm, but it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean they're, you know, these are just individual characteristics, how to use what you, the way you are for the compassion, out of compassion for others. So you're not trying to be like anyone else, you know, you're not trying to imitate Lungpa Cha or Lungpu Man. This isn't what we do, but we're learning to, you know, operate from the way we are, from the kind of character, tendency, personality, karmic tendencies that we have, because we're seeing it from the wisdom level rather than from the personal. We're not seeking popularity or approval. If we are, we begin to see that as a condition, a sakya ditti, an obstruction to the path. Integrating this into ordinary activities, just waiting in a queue. And I travel a lot. On international flights, and I began to see how, my personal tendency would be. When you're going through immigration or customs or waiting for your bags to appear on a carousel, there's this impatience. For example, waiting for your baggage, people be waiting outside to receive me in some place, and my aim was to get the bag and go out and meet the people. And if it didn't come right away, then get impatient and start thinking maybe they lost my bag or whatever. Several times they have. they found it again. But observing this, the way I would react to just this simple kind of thing of waiting for your bag to appear on a carousel is like this. So I could actually integrate mindfulness into something that was, you're just doing it to get out, you're just gritting your teeth and hoping your bag appears soon so you can go out and meet the people that have come to receive you. Or waiting in a queue for immigration, you've been on an airplane where there are a lot of people and the lines are long, you can feel as you're looking, want to get through the line as quickly as possible. And just these kind of restless activities and habits that we have in regards to waiting for the bus, waiting for the train, is a good, you can see these as opportunities to be aware of, say, the aramana, the mood that we're experiencing at that time. And through that awareness, then we stop creating that into just a reinforcing a habit, or just not noticing it anymore, but actually using a situation quite ordinary and non-threatening situation as practice of meditation. Where when we think sitting in the meditation halls where it's at, then we would see waiting in a queue as kind of an interruption to our practice. Or how are we going to relate? There's a different way of looking at waiting in a queue. Doing things like washing dishes or doing the laundry can be integrated, being aware and being with what you're doing, so you're not off in a world where you don't know what's going on, but you're aware, of the situation, because awareness allows you to be aware of the environment, the time, the place, and your own mood and emotional reactions to the conditions that you're experiencing. So like this morning I was talking about mindfulness, the sound of silence, which includes everything, this attitude of listening, not for anything in particular. You're not listening to anything in particular, but it includes everything that makes sounds in the present, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant or whatever the quality, quantity might be. The attitude is this listening, and then the quality, if it's a noise we don't like, then we feel aversion. That's a mental state we create out of our not wanting an unpleasant noise. Unpleasant noise such as my cough. I didn't want that. Another reflection is on, like, the different teachers have different methods of meditate, have certain methods or attitudes of what practice is about. And so it can be confusing because if you're learning to meditate and then you go to various ajahns or various teachers, one can become very confused by it. Because some teachers come from a very, authoritarian position. This is the only way to practice, is my way, or you've got to get something in order to become enlightened is a common one, a common way of talking. And not that these are wrong, not judgment, judging, but we can be aware of how somebody, an authority figure, affects us. For example, how do I affect you at this time? I'm in the high seat giving these reflections. And what you can know, whether I'm right or wrong, is that you feel like this. This is what you're emotionally experiencing now is the way it is. And in the Buddhist world, there are so many views and opinions about the way to practice, that and teaching, when you teach Dhamma, you tend to teach from your own experience. So fair enough, you're not, people can't really practice exactly like I do, because it's just not that way. We learn from various techniques, from various other methods. But the result is always trust your awareness of the result of if you're attached to a view or if you're caught in confusion or if the common attitudes I found was people attaching to methods of meditation without reflection. So you kind of empower somebody's method, a certain technique of practice, as if you keep doing it over and over, then you will become enlightened, rather than the method itself just leading onward toward a more awareness, to be aware of the actually, it's a helpful tool towards samadhi, towards mindfulness, but the grasping of the method can be very disappointing, because it's the grasping, the blind grasping of anything, of Buddhism itself, of positions on Dhamma, that is the obstruction. Is the obstacle. So some teacher, like I went to a conference in London years ago at the School of Oriental Studies, and it was an international conference, from scholars from all over the world on Buddhism were assembling, and I was a speaker, and most of these people were, you know, quite renowned scholars, and they had various views about Buddhism, and not many of them weren't even Buddhist or practitioners of it. And I'm not a scholar. I'm not scholastically inclined. So to me, it was a lot of it was rather boring. But I noticed when I gave my address, they didn't seem to understand what I was talking about. And yet they could come, this is a general impression I had, but scholars and people that have, like, that study a lot can come from a very kind of peremptory position, you know, this is what the Buddha actually meant, and argue about the meaning of dukkha or the function of paticca samuppada, dependent origination, and how much samadhi you should get before you do vipassana, and these kind of views, if one holds to, then they become, you know, like it, demanding that you believe it. What you can know is that when somebody talks to you in an authoritative way, this is what you feel. You feel, do you believe or trust, or do you feel intimidated? Does it create doubt or uncertainty? Does it create aversion, resistance, or loyalty? I mean, whatever reaction you're emotionally experiencing, You know it. It's like this. It's the way it is. So we don't have to kind of prove one way is right and another wrong, or that what I say is absolutely right and what some other teacher says is wrong. But what we can know at this very moment is that this is the aramana, the arom, the mood, the state, the mental state is like this. So this is beginning to, then you're beginning to trust yourself to operate from the wisdom level, the panya level, rather than through belief in teachings and doctrines and in methods of meditation and in your own personal views or what the authorities say. You're beginning to use the way things are as a path for liberation. Yes.
Involves
Yes, it certainly is. I mean, this is where, you know, it when I talk like this, it can sound very passive, like you're just sitting there watching your moods come and go and you don't do anything. But, I mean, that's the limitation of language itself. But you can also be aware of obsessive, compulsive tendencies in yourself around activity, around causes. It doesn't mean that you don't actively do things, but you can be aware of how sometimes political causes or environmental causes can be a source of a lot of suffering because of the way you're holding it. And the disappointment when, or the kind of indignation one feels when things don't go the right way. It's all grist for the mill. And people have different talents, different abilities, so that this is, you know, this doesn't, mindfulness doesn't make us into zombies or, you know, totally incapable of but sitting quietly and watching states of mind. It allows us to, when we do act, then it's in the Eightfold Path, it's samma vajja, samma gamanto, samma achievo, right speech, right action, right livelihood. So our actions are coming from wisdom rather than from just anger or indignation or obsessive tendencies. then it's truly a blessing when our actions come from wisdom. It's also a blessing. Where when our actions come from righteousness, then we tend to you know, then that becomes a very strong emotion, and we feel indignant, and you know, then you can say, "Kill the evil forces," or whatever. You know, kill the abortionists, or the animal exploiters. I mean, it goes into madness. But but it's not about annihilating the evil, but understanding. Evil is sankhara. It's not absolute. It's not permanent. So some conditions are, you have these different qualities, and when we're aware of evil, of evil thoughts in our own minds, or destructive thoughts or angry thoughts, revenge, vendetta, that kind of thing, that awareness is what is our refuge, not the judgment or the action or the speech that comes from having such feelings. Because we all, you know, like they talk about the dark side of life, and is there an absolute evil force in the universe? and these are common questions, you know. So the forces of evil dominating, and what is the nature of humanity? What is our true nature? And then, there's those that say, well, our true nature is, you know, to like a psychopath, live your life at the expense of others. Or is it, you know, is when we see with wisdom, then it doesn't mean we never have evil thoughts or emotions, but it means we know them in terms of non-action. We don't act on that. We don't speak on that. It is a sankhara, so it's the path you're seeing, but it's the passive side, you know. So we do the good when we have good thoughts, good intentions, then we can act or speak on that, and that's blessing or merit. But we can also have the opposite. Totally mean and selfish and angry thoughts. But they're also sankharas. But we refrain from acting or speaking on those sankharas. So say on the activist side, our active side is to do the good, refrain from doing the evil things that we might find in our consciousness. That's what I particularly like, the Buddhism's attitude towards morality, because I was brought up as a Christian where even a bad thought was a sin, you know. So, you know, it would be immoral. You'd have immoral thoughts or emotions. And when you're adolescent, when you're in puberty, when you're maturing, you don't know what's happening half the time, and you have all kinds of sexual thoughts and energies going through the body, and they consider them evil. At least I was told they were. So you know, what do? You feel guilty. And you feel hopeless because you think, you know, that it's, you shouldn't have this, such things, such thoughts or fantasies or whatever. With Buddhism, the emphasis on sila, on morality, is it's about action and speech, not around thought. So there's not such thing as immoral thought. A thought can be, you know, have different qualities of good and bad, but then as we develop wisdom, then we trust in our actions, our relationship to our family, to our society, is to do the good and refrain from doing the bad. And that's balance, and that's wisdom. It doesn't mean you only have good thoughts for the rest of your life. But even the bad ones are part knowledge, and because they are impermanent, conditioned phenomena, and not self. And that makes life, we aren't, you know, in teaching in the UK for so many years, there's so many guilt problems, people guilty about things they've said or done in the past. And so it's interesting to see people, very good people, you know. Most of the people, you know, that come to monasteries are trying to be on the best behavior. But I noticed that guilt can be an obsessive concern, regret or remembering things you've done or said that you feel guilty about. And so guilt is because you remember, and you feel guilty, because we've all done things, you know, on unkind things or things we wished we hadn't done or said in the past. But with wisdom, then guilt becomes another sankhara, arising, ceasing. We're being able to to use it as seeing it for what it really is in the present. If it's like this, we're accepting it. We're not convincing ourselves we have nothing to be guilty of, but we're looking at it from the wisdom position rather than from social mores or religious teachings. We're seeing that this is an emotion. If we have done things in the past that we regret, then we can, if we can, we apologize or make amends at best. But so much of it is so long ago that there's nothing much we can do about it. But we can use it as with this wisdom, mindfulness and wisdom. Also, because we tend to suppress, we're afraid of evil. A lot of fear. And fear is a primal kind of emotion. This is a fear realm we're living in. There's a survival. It's survival of the fittest, law of the jungle. In Thailand, I live right next to a national park where, it's a real jungle of survival for the animal kingdom. And, we consider ourselves civilized, so we can make agreements about our behavior. We can agree not to kill, or at least other human beings. So like the first precept, bana dibata, is a moral agreement by all of us not to intentionally kill another human being. Now this is a gift we have as human beings. Our species can do this. The animal world can't do that. You ask a cat to not kill birds because it's immoral. They don't understand. you can threaten them when you're around, they don't chase birds, but when you're gone, they do. But because that's their nature. That's what they're supposed to do, actually. And it's morality doesn't apply. But for the human species, we have these social agreements, moral agreements. Now just think if everybody, and this is being very far out, but if everybody in the world took the first precept, that would be the end of war, wouldn't it? All these terrible things going on in the Middle East, and there's no agreement on bana dibata. It's the power, fear, threatening, using fear and threats and power to dominate, to resolve conflict. So you suppress it is the best you can achieve with that. But the actual elegance of being human is that we can agree. It doesn't mean we never feel the desire to kill anything. It's not that. But we don't act on that desire. Like the second precept of not taking things that have not been given. This is, we might feel the impulse to steal or take things that aren't ours, but we don't act on them. It's our inactive side, but it doesn't mean we never have that kind of desire. Sexuality, like Gamme Sumicha, is about learning to not use sexuality for just selfish ends, for just using others or abusing oneself, getting obsessed with it. So that our sexuality, we can agree how we're going to respond to situations, but by refraining from acting just on lustful impulses. But we can be aware of lustful impulses, their sankharas, and seeing them in this, and then this game sumicha is that kind of moral agreement we make as Buddhists. And then the fourth samavajja is about refraining from using speech. There's a conflict now in the world around political correctness. And yet, free speech is the attitude of the time. You know, I have a right to say anything I want to say. I was a student in Berkeley in the early 60s, the free speech movement. And that was, I remember on the Berkeley campus, University of California, you know, they have these meetings and demand right to use the F word in public. I didn't particularly want to devote my life to this kind of freedom. But it's free speech. Why not? We're free individuals to say what we're thinking. And then this political correctness is even more confusing because you're not supposed to say things that offend people, and yet you have a right to say anything. So if you're confused, it's the time, it's the way things are. But in samavajja, right speech, notice that this is right speech or skillful speech rather than political correctness or freedom of speech. And I remember telling monks how grateful I am for all the things I've never said. Thinking back, things I felt like saying, I've never said them. and where right speech is knowing time and place, how to communicate, learning to use our ability to speak so that it's communicative, it's helpful, it leads onward, it's encouraging, it's not insulting or abusing or looking down on people. And this, you know, is right speech. So this is learning to be responsible for what we say. Sometimes we want to use abusive speech or we feel angry and we want to lash out and say things. So one still can feel that way, but refrain from speaking on it. And this is a human species. This is what we can do. You know, it's what civilization really means to agree on moral action and speech. What are the boundaries set by? Sometimes it's without wisdom, so it tends to be oppressive. Morality can seem oppressive because it comes from fear. You know, you'll go to hell if you break a precept, or if you tell a lie, you go to some kind of horrible place in the afterlife. And so a lot of obeying laws and moral precepts is through fear of punishment. Because that's how we're conditioned. Modern life is about being rewarded for being good and punished for being bad. But this isn't about fear, it's about wisdom. So fear is, you know, I can frighten you into obeying me, and you may keep all the rules and behave yourself out of fear. But then with mindfulness, you know, this is, you're aware of fear, and then I'm put in the position of a tyrant. Or the Buddha is not a tyrannical teacher, you know, he's not, you don't detect any tyrannical tendencies in Buddha's teaching, because it's not based on fear, but on wisdom. Not on guilt and that, but on wisdom, awakening. So like living one's life, like the in the Theravada and Buddhist style, we have the dana sila bhavana. Dana is generosity. That when we're generous, when we're not stingy and mean-hearted and selfish, that makes our life, we're a much more pleasant life. We're happier. Let's think of being totally selfish and ungrateful and thinking only of yourself. It's not a mental state that is peaceful. When you look at it, when one has those kind of tendencies, you're aware of it as it's dukkha, it's suffering to be selfish. And then generosity creates gratitude in the society. People are grateful and sharing things. Qualities like this we can do to make our lives pleasant ones and develop a sense of self-respect, beginning to appreciate life in the way we're living it through being generous, and then the sila, the five precepts. It's worthy of respect, one who attempts to keep the five precepts. So you develop self-respect with dana sila. So the very foundation of Buddha Dhamma in terms of individual living in society isn't based on fear, but on reflection. We need to have a sense of self-worth, self-respect, even, you know, from our own actions and way we live. If we're living in a way we don't respect, then we're going to feel guilty and worthless and despairing. But dana sila brings this sense of hiri otapa into our consciousness, sense of self-respect and proper behavior in the society, so we're not, you know, being a force that causes division and strife in the family or in the society we're in. And this leads on to bhavana, which is the cultivation of wisdom, the Eightfold Path. Oh, and this is the blessing of being born in the human form. human species. And yet, so much of modern life doesn't recognize that. It's power and fear that tend to be used. And they talk about morality, but even morality can be a threat. You know, you refrain from immoral actions out of fear of going to hell rather than through understanding the suffering you create through unskillful actions and speech. When you observe the result of unskillful actions and speech, then there's wisdom. You say, when you say things that you wish you hadn't, and there's guilt and remorse as a result of that, then that's learning also, that better refrain from saying those kind of things. Not only for the sake of others, but for your own peace of mind, happiness. Well, we have, being born as a human, mean we're still mammals, and and we've got these basic primal instincts, survival and procreation, and so I mean these are kind of part of the package, you know, whether you're born as a dog or a human being, you have these kind of primal instincts for survival of the species and procreation of the species. And so this is where in the human species we can reflect on that. We're not just we experience those same kind of feelings of fear, primal fear, and anger and lust for procreation. I mean, these are part of why we still multiply. I mean, there's more human beings on the planet than ever recorded, and there weren't this many human beings at the time of the Buddha. The overpopulation is a question of a problem to worry about in the future, or now even, can they make it into a problem? But also you can look at the potential for humanity, you know, as human beings, as we're allowed to be aware of the value of our humanity, where if it's just, you know, power and wealth and competitiveness and get what you can for yourself and then of course it does lead to destruction, war, misery, pain, grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. But do we really understand what it is to be human? And then as I was saying before, previous day, like the Buddha is about a human being who's awake and enlightened. And so it's not about, I mean, we respect the historical Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, because this is, you know, we have these memories, these perceptions of the founder of what we consider Buddhism to this day. But also, human beings can reflect on fear. You're not just a helpless, lost in fear creature. You can be aware of greed, of hatred, of fear, of delusion, and so forth. And that's the Buddha knowing Dhamma. That's the Bhutang Tamang Sangkang Dhamma Sami reference. I mean, these are Pali words, you know, but I mean, they do have, they're very helpful as you go along to take, you get a sense of real refuge as you internalize that and not just see it as a kind of external ceremony or seeing Buddha as some kind of Buddha nature in outer space or in the forest. I mean, it's here, you know, you're that. And learning to trust that, and then it leads on to being able to use these primal instincts, like the stream enterer, the Sotapanna, is aware of the human made things that the human beings create, such as the ego and the cultural, social conditioning and the thinking process. But after stream entry, there's still sexual desire and anger, aversion, because these are natural conditions that are part of the species, you know, the mammalian creatures that we are. But our relationship to them is reflecting, no longer interpreting them in the sakya ditti, in the personal way. Like with sexuality, people, you know, this is a big question now about sexual orientation, and people so strongly identified with their sexual inclinations. And this becomes a whole raison d'etre for living and to be accepted in whatever sexual tendencies you might have. It becomes a strong identity. Being Jewish or something like this is a very strong identity with a perception. Or being, you know, a racial identity, being black or whatever is. These are strong identities that we believe in totally and commit ourselves to, where with the stream entry, we no longer, we see through that tendency. It's not that we don't still have it, but we're not making it into an obsession, into a reason for action and speech and livelihood. So we have wisdom to guide us through to deal with the procreation instincts and energies of a male or female body, of the aversion, anger that arise, that we experience, and fear. There's a lot to fear in the planet Earth. You know, it's not like some neuroses where if there's still the self-view, then it becomes neurotic fear. Fear when there's no need to be frightened and no wisdom operating around it. Just seen always interpreted as, I have a fear problem. And we go to psychotherapists to deal with it. But actually, the Sakadagami, it still has those basic primal instincts. But there's wisdom seeing the path, rather than right understanding to see it in terms of what it really is, that these are conditions arising, ceasing. Sape sankara anicca. Sape dhammanatta, all conditioned, all dhamma is not personal anymore. We don't interpret anger and fear and sexual desire in terms of personal identity. We see it in terms of its reality in the present. And as sankhara, it has, you know, then like aversion and anger are kind of protective. I mean, animal kingdom is full of that, you know, just to protect the young, or the animals compete with each other. We've got these same kind of animal instincts, but our relationship to them changes from being animals to just following instinct to being Buddhas, or refuge in Buddha, to see them in terms of sankharas. And then there's the moral agreements, the five precepts, the 10 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts, monastic vinaya and so forth, that are agreements on behavior and on etiquette, relinquishing a lot, you know, simplifying life. Monastic life is a simplification of life. So I used to think being born as a human being was a curse. I thought, you know, it'd be better to be born as a sheep or a cow. Because they, you know, they have fear and anger, but they don't remember what happened 5 years ago. Or they don't seem to worry about the future. In Switzerland, I remember thinking, it'd be nice to be a cow in Switzerland. But being a human being, I mean, you've got this retentive memory, you've got critical mind, things are never good enough, you know, contentment is not part of modern life, you know. To be content means you're stupid. You said, you know, modern free market capitalism all is about making you as discontented as possible. So last year's model is old-fashioned. You know, you're discontented with it. You imagine being content with your old car of 2 or 3 years ago when they're presenting you with something so much better. And so, you know, it winds you up into wanting, into greed, and being discontented. This is the society we live in. Now, just pointing it out that this is the way it is. I'm not, you know, it shouldn't be this way, then I become idealistic. But this is the social environment that affects us. But we can learn from it, you know. It's not about, we can't, you know, we should, it shouldn't be like this. Then we just complain about it. Or we just say, nothing we can do, it's just the way it is, so what? And resign ourselves. Or we can actually learn from it, you know. So how a materialistic society, how it affects us. It affects us like this, makes us want things we don't need, or be discontented with what we have is like this. So discontentment, you can't just be contented as an act of will. You know, you can attach to the idea of being contented, but contentment comes through seeing the suffering of discontentment. This is where monastic life excels, because it's about content with little, you know. So it doesn't mean we're that I was always content with what I had, but I became aware, more increasingly aware of the suffering I create through discontentment, through wanting things I didn't have, and what I have not good enough. Just being aware of that mental state of wanting something better than what I have. So in the Samanasanya practices, they have these reflections that we chant in the pujas about being content with the four requisites, with the shelter for the night, for alms food, medicine for illness that is made available, robes, so that, and the standard for these four requisites is as low as you can get, like bangsakula cloth, which is, you know, these papa ceremonies from Thailand where they offer, that means forest cloth, meaning throwaway cloth found in the forest. And then the lay disciples gain so much respect for the early bhikkhus that they asked the Buddha if they could offer good cloth, because the Buddha allowed us to pick up rags and cloth that the villagers had discarded to make our robes. You know, so we could go into charnel grounds and take the cloth off corpses. And you can imagine anything more desperate than that. And then the villagers wanted to offer, you know, good cloth as an offering. The Buddha allowed that. So that's like the katina ceremonies after the pansa and the towain forest cloth. Sometimes in Sri Lanka, I think they even drape the cloth over trees, and you you know, like new robes and that. This is a way of, this part of the ceremony of offering. But it's like, it doesn't mean that you're always content with your robes, but you're also aware of discontentment. And through that, you let go of the discontentment. It's like, you know, when you know that putting your finger in the flame of the candle hurts, you immediately withdraw it. You don't seek to be hurt and harmed anymore. So it's time for me to cease.